Cross, Wisconsin from Civic Media. This is Up North News Radio. Now, live from our Lake Wissota studio, here's the founding editor of Up North News, Pat Breitlow.
Well, hey there, Wisconsin. Good morning. Welcome to the State of Common Sense from the shores of Lake Wissota, where it's a beautiful day up north on this Friday, June 30th. July is right on the doorstep, a very hazy doorstep, but the doorstep just the same. Coming up tomorrow, it is 63 degrees up here on the lake. Here's what's on tap this morning. We're going to learn more about, it appears that Donald Trump's wife is Morgan Fairchild. You'd have to be a fan of the old John Lovitz SNL skit about the congenital liar. But former President Donald Trump was offering new excuses for having and waving around classified documents. It turns out they were building plans for a golf course. Yeah, that's the ticket. Anyway, it's part of a review of this week's national headlines with Courier Newsroom political writer Kia Vakil. That's coming up later this hour. And then, good news, everyone. Institutional racism is gone. It's solved, at least according to the six right-wing justices on the U.S. Supreme Court, who ruled on Thursday that it's okay that college campuses are about to get a lot whiter. And we will talk to Mark Jacob about the affirmative action case. And we'll also get into how newsrooms fixated on division and cynicism can get their audiences to look at a growing economy like this and decide that a recession must be imminent. We'll also talk a little sports with Dan Schumacher, and we're going to give away Brewers tickets. One trivia question, not the easiest one, not the hardest one, one Brewers trivia question later this hour, and it's going to be a four-pack of tickets to Monday afternoon's game. The Brewers are still on their road trip. They wrapped up last night in New York. Now they're heading to Pittsburgh for the weekend. They're back starting Monday with a series against the Cubs. And we have a four-pack of tickets to give away later this hour to Monday afternoon's game. Speaking of Monday, no live show on Monday or Tuesday as I take a long holiday weekend. We'll be back with live shows on Wednesday, but we have had a lot of great guests and segments in the past, and so I hope you'll still tune in and give a listen to something that you might have missed along the way. Another way to do that would be to go to the show's website at civicmedia.us. You'll find all the shows there and each hour of every show. So you can just click on any given hour and listen back to a guest like, you know, Hometown Health yesterday, somebody that we had on, and get the show that way. But if you're listening live and want to join in at any point today, 844-967-2789 is the studio line. Aaron Zommers is back after a day when he was moving. I was a little surprised you took just one day instead of the whole weekend to do it. I'm sure there's still a lot of work to do.
Yeah, I should have taken 2 days, but I didn't want to put everyone else here in a bind with the shows. And I figured, you know what? I work early enough in the day that I'll have plenty of time. Even if it's the same amount of time, it'll feel like I have more time to get stuff done after work.
I hope you all are hearing this, because remember, at the end of the show yesterday, Luke Mathers, who's working his tail off for Civic Media as well, he actually had to leave in mid-segment because he had so much other work to do. We have the most dedicated people here at Civic Media. I mean, I don't mean that as a compliment. They really should stay home more. They're killing themselves here. But I appreciate the dedication and that you got up here. I think Calvin did a very capable job. And I would have liked you to have more time to get things done. But you know, that work ethic is only going to be rewarded with an early grave if you keep that up. So just keep that in mind, Aaron.
That's a good point. You know, at least I'm not overworking myself as much as the aforementioned Luke Mathers.
Yeah, that guy's really putting in the hours. But you know, everybody is. You guys are growing a network here, much like we're growing, you know, Up North News, which is a separate entity, but still these two different startup groups that I'm working with. One of the best parts about it is watching how hard people work, because they want to see this thing, you know, take off and be successful. And it really is appreciated. So this weekend for me, it will be grandkids coming up, the one-year-old granddaughter and the four-year-old grandson. So yesterday started the process of pulling toys out of the shed that, you know, we only have when any of the grandkids are around. So that includes in the category of, you know, they don't make things like they used to. when our girls were very little, like about 3 and 5 or something like that, we bought your classic, you know, little red wagon. It's I think it was from Sears. You know, it's got a wooden platform and then like red slats all around it that you can remove if need be. And I have to do a little touch-up work on it today, but I am always impressed with when some of the old stuff hangs around that long, because how many things fall apart after a year or two, you know?
Definitely.
That little red wagon hanging in there.
I was going to say, even if that does get messed up, you can probably just repair it yourself.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And that's what I'll be doing here. And then I'll spend the rest of the time trying to keep the four-year-old from, you know, wheeling it into traffic. But, you know, hopefully that'll work out. Hey, in the Up North News newsletter, we have Christina Laurie was on and talking about food trucks the other day. And she's got a couple of stories in there, one about various food trucks in Wisconsin, and then a little profile on one family who kind of makes their food truck a family affair. So that's in there. And there's also an editorial that I wrote for Independence Day. And it's all about maintaining our own independence by putting our country first, rather than blind partisanship to any one party or any one individual, especially if that individual might be trying to undermine the very democracy, you know, upon which our independence is based. So I hope you will check that out either in the newsletter or online. All right, we've got a few headlines to pass along to you and an update on the Brewers wrapping up their series against the Mets. That's all coming up next here on Up North News Radio. All right, kids, it's my birthday weekend, so I'm going to take a little host prerogative here and tell you that the number one album on this day in 1984 was Sports by Huey Lewis and the News, and so we're going to be hearing cuts from the Sports album throughout the morning here on Up North News Radio. All right, the Brewers managed to win the series against the Mets in New York, a 3-2 victory. And that allowed the Brewers to win 3 out of 4 against the Metropolitans. Victor Caratini hit a 2-run homer in the 6th to tie the game. And in the 7th, with the bases loaded, Brian Anderson just missed a grand slam, but the sacrifice fly to deep right center was enough to score what would become the winning run. Now the Brewers are in Pittsburgh for games Friday, Saturday, and Sunday before coming home on Monday to start a series with the Cubs. We have a 4-pack of tickets to give away later this hour to Monday afternoon's game, so stay tuned. And of course, throughout the weekend and throughout the season, Civic Media has 2 stations on the Brewers Radio Network, and they include Oshkosh Air Support, 98.3 and 1100 AM all across the Fox Valley, and News from the Center in Richland Center, 107.7 FM and 1450 AM. All right, time to share some headlines and thoughts. And as always, the studio line is open at 844-967-2789. If you'd like to react to them, vent a little, share what else is on your mind with people on stations all across the state of Wisconsin. To no one's surprise, the state assembly on a party line vote did send the state budget bill off to Governor Evers. There were no amendments added in the assembly. There were no amendments added the day before in the Senate. So what came out of the Republican-controlled Joint Finance Committee is the bill that Governor Evers is going to have to weigh and decide whether to sign it, whether to sign it with some partial vetoes, or whether to veto the whole thing and tell Republicans to start over. Now, as noted, for example, in this Journal Sentinel story by Tyler Katzenberger, there are things not included in this state budget, more than 500 proposed items from Evers that Republicans stripped out that would have created a family leave program, would have expanded Medicaid, would have extended pandemic-era funding for childcare to keep childcare affordable and address the worker shortage, legalized marijuana, add mental health programs in schools, several measures aimed at addressing PFAS contamination. So many things that Evers asked for, and Republicans said no. Democrats, of course, blasted the budget plan, saying that it was full of missed opportunities. And that's because the state has a record $7 billion surplus. And even though Governor Evers had a tax cut in there for the middle class, Republicans went with a tax cut that is heavily weighted toward the highest income households. State Representative Robin Vining of Wauwatosa said, for example, "We have so many people counting on us, and we had so much opportunity in this budget, so many options, so much money, and we did not do what is best for Wisconsin with this budget. This budget is not good, it's not fair, not just, not right." So the question becomes, what's your advice for Governor Evers? Should he just veto this and then spend the summer trying to negotiate some other kind of better deal? Or should he do what he can with partial vetoes? And again, for those of us who like to talk about, you know, state politics, because a state budget's a very important document, you know, there are pros and cons to both approaches. There is the possibility that you reach a deal, much like the school funding deal, where public schools did get more funding, but voucher schools got a lot more funding. And, you know, did that turn out to be a fair trade or not? So anything is possible if you end up negotiating again. I did record some of the floor debate from the Assembly and Senate. And I think in the coming days, maybe we'll play back various clips just to, you know, set the record straight on what some legislators are going to be saying when they get back home, and how the things that they're saying may not necessarily jive with what the people of Wisconsin actually want. So we'll look at doing that now that the legislature is out of session until at least September, unless the governor does veto the budget and they have to come back to try to override the vetoes. So we'll continue to follow what he does and let you know what is and isn't in what was a tremendous opportunity, probably a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to fix things in our budget that year after year after year, we said, well, if only we, you know, we had a little bit more money, we could fix this for good. And Republicans said, nah. Even cut funding for the University of Wisconsin system, something with a worldwide reputation. People all over the world know the UW system. They know how good it is. They want to be there. They want their kids to go there. The only people who like to hate on it are people from other Big Ten schools in sports and Republicans in our legislature who actually took funding away with a $7 billion surplus, took away just the right amount of money that the university uses to help encourage diversity and equity and inclusion, because apparently that's racist. I don't know. Seems appropriate that we're talking about that at the same time that a conservative-dominated U.S. Supreme Court has decided that institutional racism is all gone. It's solved. We don't need to do anything about it anymore. The six right-wing justices declared in a decision yesterday about affirmative action that race cannot be a factor in college admissions. It's a decision that's going to force institutions of higher learning to look for new ways to achieve diverse student bodies. Some schools have used the practice for decades as a way to address racial discrimination against Black students and others who had long been excluded from America's colleges. Now, they're not racial quotas that reserve a certain number of seats for minority students. Those were deemed unconstitutional quite a few years ago. But up until yesterday, courts had said, and the Supreme Court had said up until yesterday, that colleges can consider race as long as it's one of many factors in its decision. Students' race can be used as basically a plus factor to give them an edge. It just can't be the defining factor. Well, here's where I have to admit, there are a lot of subjects where somebody can say to me, "Hey, Pat," and I'll say, "What?" And they'll say, "Pat, what's the deal with this topic? Or that topic, or that topic." And I'll give some background that hopefully is well-informed and fact-based and accounts for historical milestones and give some pros and cons whenever I can. I will admit to you that college admissions is not something I can speak to with a lot of research or experience or exposure. And as I'm reading the reaction pieces to yesterday's Supreme Court decision, it left me thinking that the college admissions process has always been kind of complex, and I think is now going to be even more so as it moves into what Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson called the pink elephant stage. In other words, I can't tell you not to think about a pink elephant, because that's the first thing that's going to pop into your head. And so when Chief Justice John Roberts writes the following, he says, "Nothing in this opinion should be construed as prohibiting universities from considering an applicant's discussion of how race affected his or her life, be it through discrimination, inspiration, or otherwise. And the student must be treated based on his or her experiences as an individual, not on the basis of race." When he writes that, I think, well, how's that going to work? Or to quote a New York Times story, "For outside skeptics, untangling a university's intentions will be challenging. How can they know whether an admissions decision was based on an essay about personal grit or the race of the applicant that was revealed through the essay?" What I know is this. This decision strikes me that it was not in any way, shape, or form some kind of victory for merit and equality. Far from it. This was one for people who brought the case, a victory for people who are not only not champions for equality, but who will fight any effort to acknowledge and push back against the forms of racism that live on to this day, many of them subtle, institutional, systemic, but still very much in existence. The funny thing for me is that there just has never seemed to be a good reason for this. Why would you push back against efforts to have more diversity? Why would you push back against efforts to be more honest about our history? It just seems like all the pushbacks are rooted in some form of either one, let's all be colorblind starting right now. Doesn't work that way. Or two, how dare you imply that any white person is still prejudiced or privileged? I consider that a personal attack, and you are teaching my children to hate themselves. And related arguments like that that just make me embarrassed for them. If you refuse to acknowledge the stains of our past, which might include any of our ancestors, you know, however wonderful great-great-grandpa Charlie was, he might have also been somebody who engaged in redlining as a banker or chased a young family out of his neighborhood, you know, 120 years ago. Our past is our past. It's not all roses and sunshine. Its legacy is with us still. And we were reminded about that in the dissent from Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, where she said, "Race-based gaps still exist. Gulf-sized gaps still exist. With respect to health, wealth, and the well-being of American citizens." And I would add parenthetically, don't forget about the justice system, the education system. I mean, we have done the articles at Up North News about the proof is in the data about how two different people, you know, one white, one black, are going to get different treatment. And it's not that the people in the institution are racist. It's that the processes and the traditions in there continue to reinforce a disadvantage for one person versus the other. Jackson adds that although these disparities emerged years ago, ignoring the history would be foolish because those inequities have indisputably been passed down to the present day through generations, through Jim Crow and the Great Migration, which I would add to places like Milwaukee. And Justice Jackson laid out how Black families struggled against a legal system aimed at preventing them from building wealth. Now, she did focus on the strength and fortitude they showed. She said, despite these barriers, Black people persisted. But to say racial biases are all gone now, if it's something we, quote, refuse to see, much less solve for, these race-linked disparities will continue to impede the achievement of our great nation's potential. That's basically a long way of saying, look, embrace diversity, or at least stop getting in the way of those who are trying to encourage the diversity that will help our nation continue its transition toward equal opportunities for all. Because with every roadblock, we delay that transition. We may not see billy clubs and fire hoses anymore. The roadblocks are less physical, but no less troublesome, whether it's a Supreme Court decision or something like Robin Voss and Republicans actually reducing UW system funding by the exact dollar amount they believe goes toward diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. Robin Voss and the Republicans don't have to swing a club or blast a hose. They know how to write budgets. They know one quote from Martin Luther King and how to take it out of context. They know how to buy elections for the White House and state Supreme Court seats. If you want our great experiment to scrub the stain of racism from our country, you can complain and you can march, but you'd better vote. Kia Vakil's next. You're up.
Different things to talk about with Courier News International correspondent Kia Vakil, who joins us from Los Angeles. Kia, good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Pat. You bet.
Hey, we're going to talk about the Supreme Court decision on independent state legislature theory and how it could have thrown Wisconsin elections into chaos. But first, we're going to have a little fun at the expense of former President Donald Trump. It is a serious story, but I couldn't help but notice that Trump has a new excuse for the audio that you hear him shuffling all these papers, and he talks about them being top secret and I could declassify them. But I mean, the guy can't keep one story straight. He's always switching stories on this.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that tends to happen when there's audio released that contradicts your own story from a week ago. And, you know, we'll see what happens next week in terms of contradicting this week's excuse. But, you know, now he's saying, to back up a little bit, there was a recording released Monday from, I believe, CNN and the New York Times got it. Mm-hmm. It's of a Trump meeting in 2021 with people who were working on a biography of Mark Meadows, who was Trump's chief of staff. In that meeting, Trump is heard rustling papers, talking about having military documents that depict, you know, how potentially they would attack Iran. And he explicitly says it's secret, it's classified, how he didn't classify it. And, you know, that transcript was reported a few weeks ago, but the audio came out Monday. And, you know, pretty much Trump admits to having these. And so since that audio has come out, Trump's now saying it's, quote, bravado. He's saying it wasn't those papers. He just held up other papers. I believe he said it's fake news. He's, you know, he just went on some crazy diatribes.
Including now saying that, well, what he was talking about, those were building plans. He was talking about building plans for a golf course. What? No. I mean, honestly, I expected the next thing for him to say, yeah, they were building plans for a golf course. I was looking at them with my wife, Morgan Fairchild. And if you're too young to know the John Lovitz Saturday Night Live reference, well, I'm sorry, but all of us old people think that's damn funny that this is what this guy is doing right now about classified documents. But then there's the guy running against him for the Republican nomination, the one closest to him in current polling, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who has also not had the world's best week when it comes to taking positions. In this case, he's trying to sound all tough on crime and everything, but he ends up contradicting himself in wanting to appear tough on crime.
Yeah, I mean, Ron DeSantis has come out this week saying when he was in Congress in 2018, he voted for Trump's very modest criminal justice reform bill called the First Step Act. He celebrated it when he ran for governor. You know, as recently as I think 2019, he still was sort of talking about it as a positive thing. And now he's criticizing it. He's calling it the jailbreak bill.
And maybe thinking he'd never, like, nobody would look and say you were for it before you were against it. It just seems to fit with the pattern on the Republican side of whatever it takes to you know, scare people and talk about crime and immigration and everything else, even if you have to contradict the way that you voted initially. And it just really makes you wonder, what does he really think?
Oh, I don't believe. I mean, the Republicans are not shy about, you know, reversing positions or completely ignoring their entire record and then changing, you know, where they stand on something. And it's notable because, yes, crime went up in the pandemic. Turns out a globally destabilizing crisis can lead to people having, you know, problems and lead to higher crime. That makes a lot of sense to me. It is going down this year, though. Murder rates are down in mass in most big cities, anywhere between, you know, a couple percent and well over 30%. So, you know, in Milwaukee, it's down substantially by about 33%, according to the most recent data. Baltimore, it's down 24%. LA, where I am, it's down 23%. Philadelphia, down 24%. So, like, murder is down. They want to focus on it because there's no... Their last crisis fear-mongering about the border in Title 42 didn't come to pass, so now they've jumped back to crime. And obviously, DeSantis needs to gain on the polls, so he's going to fear-monger about crime, also fear-monger about immigration, which he did this week, and ignore that he previously voted for these modest reforms. So yeah, it's all just political, you know, BS.
Right. And when you look at the people who were released under the First Step Act, mm-hmm. the Justice Department put out figures that said the recidivism rate, which means they were rearrested, reconvicted, returned to prison, the recidivism rate was about 12%. But in the general population, the overall recidivism rate for federal prisoners is 49%. So mm-hmm. it's not even close to being, you know, this more dangerous thing than what currently existed. And you can't ever say that you're going to have some kind of a program with zero recidivism. But if you're looking for an improvement, you know, for a brief shining moment there, both Donald Trump and Ron DeSantis got it right. But it never seems to come up in election years, does it?
No. And you know, he's going to do what he's going to do. He's losing to Donald Trump by anywhere between 20 and 40 points based on the polls. So being tough on crime, tough on immigration, tough on gay people, tough on women, that's what he thinks is going to get him to get to rise in the polls.
And unfortunately, that's the mindset of so many other Republicans who are in the race. And by the way, there's a lot of them, you know, Politico and others were doing stories this week with the headline, "How the 2024 GOP Field Got So Big." And I mean, what's your take on why so many Republicans are now calling themselves presidential candidates?
I think the Politico headline got quite right. It says ego, pure delusion, and fantasy. and I do think that's what it is. You know, I think for folks like, you know, Doug Burgum, Larry Elder, you know, Vivek Ramaswamy, Asa Hutchinson, all these people who almost no Americans have ever heard of, Perry Johnson, Francis Suarez. If you haven't heard of these guys, there's a reason. They are largely irrelevant on the national political scene. They have no chance at winning the nomination. You know, outside of Trump, DeSantis, let's say Tim Scott, Nikki Haley, Pence, like there's some contenders, Chris Christie, who, you know, have something they can point to. But it got big because people have egos. Some of these people are absolutely angling for the vice presidency under Trump or a cabinet post. Some of them just want to promote themselves and have the money to do it. And for some of them, it might just be a game. You know, they want to appear in the press. They want their name all over, you know, the New York Times. But it's they don't stand a chance.
No, they don't. And look, I always use the example of, you know, Jimmy Carter, who came out of nowhere seemingly in 1976. But the Politico article does say that, you know, there is one recent example, and that would be Pete Buttigieg, who yeah. went from the mayor of the fourth largest city in Indiana to, you know, winning the Iowa caucuses. And he, you know, turned that into, you know, a six-figure podcast deal and then became a cabinet secretary in the Biden administration. But again, it's not just anybody who can do that. He had the talent. He was extremely well-spoken on the issues. And you can't say that about most people who simply want to attach the name former presidential candidate, you know, to the end of their business card.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Buttigieg had a knack for communicating with voters. And I think more importantly, there was no clear Democratic figurehead at that time. It was post-Obama. You know, Biden obviously won that nomination, but that was not a sure thing at all. You know, famously, Buttigieg won that Iowa caucus. Biden did not really rally until South Carolina in the primaries. And on the Republican side, you have a figurehead. You have Trump, who has not gone away. So it's not remotely the same where there's kind of a void. Instead, you have the guy, Trump, who's still around, and then kind of his mini-me in DeSantis. And so that did not exist in 2020 for Democrats. So there was a lane for someone like Buttigieg. I don't think that exists this year. You know, the non-Trump lane, there's really only room for one candidate. And that is likely going to be someone like DeSantis, maybe Tim Scott. But, you know, these folks are going to cannibalize each other, and he's just going to sail to the nomination.
Yeah, exactly. Now, whenever they do get a nominee and we get into the election, it looks like well, I'm not going to promise it will be less chaotic, but there will be one less factor involved. And that's something called independent state legislature theory, which we talked about briefly on Wednesday morning. But I wanted to have you talk about it again, just to remind folks once again how close we come to having real threats to democracy. We came so close in the past in the U.S. Supreme Court. We came so close with the Wisconsin Supreme Court nearly taking on a case that would have overthrown the will of the voters. And this time around, a 6-3 ruling means there are still three justices on the U.S. Supreme Court right now who would have embraced this cuckoo theory that state legislatures could simply overturn the will of the voters. It's crazy.
Yeah, it's a particularly extreme theory. It would have effectively given, you know, the U.S. has checks and balances just in general in terms of the legislature, the executive branch, and the judiciary. What this theory would have done had the court embraced it was give legislators like the ones in North Carolina and Wisconsin, which love to gerrymander and pass strict voter ID laws, they would have had, there would have been no recourse for any other branch of government or election official to, you know, provide oversight or challenge these, you know, clearly partisan and unconstitutional laws. So it would have given legislators a total monopoly on election laws. And the court did not embrace that theory. They also rejected the notion that these legislators could theoretically throw out voters' decision, like the Trump campaign tried to do after 2020. They embraced this theory, some of his legal advisors, to try to get, you know, in Wisconsin, famously, alternate electors appointed. That, you know, those efforts failed. But to suggest that state lawmakers who don't like the way voters vote could just overturn those votes is anti-democratic. It's border, I would argue it's fascist. And so the court agreed that, you know, no, legislators don't have that power to automatically just do that. And that's a good thing.
And with any hope, Congressman Tom Tiffany is listening and won't, you know, sign on to lawsuits anymore that would do that kind of thing. Last stop is with the president himself. He gave an address in Chicago on Wednesday where he embraced the term Bidenomics. And I would contrast that with former President Barack Obama, who did not like the term Obamacare. He said, it's not about me. He liked calling it the Affordable Care Act. And then Republicans used Obamacare, you know, they tried to use it as an insult, essentially. But we've been talking about Reaganomics for so long, which has never worked. And you couldn't really do Clintonomics or Obamanomics or whatever. So if Bidenomics is the name you're going to give to something that says Reaganomics has never worked, why don't we try this approach instead? I'll sign on for it. Maybe you're not the biggest fan of the term.
Yeah, it's not my favorite term, but I think the idea of trying to embrace and push the economy in connection with him is a smart one. Ultimately, you know, there's some Democrats who think he should be more cautious, but people are going to associate the economy with the president no matter what. And you know, the economy, again, yes, inflation has been an issue, as it has been everywhere in the world. Our recovery has been stronger than any other country's, and that's in large part a credit to the Biden administration and the federal policies that they've passed. I think that's fair to say. Did they get everything done they wanted to? No. Are there still issues, especially with rent costs and grocery costs? Absolutely. But the economy is recovering. The job creation has been really high in every state across the country for the past year. Manufacturing and construction sectors are booming. Infrastructure investments are being announced every single day. They've raised taxes on corporations, not as much as they wanted to, but what they were able to get through the Senate. That's a pretty solid list of accomplishments. And trying to get voters to know about them is just good campaign strategy.
And voters hate it when Democrats always try to, like, you know, back away from something, like, don't call it this. Say, just take it. Take it. Own the title Bidenomics. Run with it and show how you think it's better. That I think that's just, you know, just like you said, own it. Run with it. Kiev Akil, national correspondent for Courier Newsroom. Thanks so much. Have a great holiday weekend.
You too.
All right, and like I need to tell you again, we are going to be giving away 4 tickets to Monday's Brewers game against the Cubs at American Family Field. That's part of our history lesson and music break. That's coming up next here up north.
From the bottom of my heart, I love you. What more can I say?
If you haven't guessed, that would be a very young Frank Sinatra. It was on this day in 1939 that old Blue Eyes began touring with the Harry James Orchestra. It all started at the Hippodrome Theater in Baltimore on this day in 1939. And that Sinatra kid from Hoboken, it worked out all right for him after that. Couple of other history notes, and then we're going to give away some Brewers tickets here. It was on this day in 1559 that King Henry II of France was killed in a jousting match. Setting a rule for kings moving forward, don't take part in jousting matches. Also on this day in 1937, the world's first emergency telephone number was introduced in London, 999. And it made me wonder, of course, I had to go look it up, you know, why are they 999 and why are we 911? Apparently, we learned a lesson from them, too much pocket dialing. It's too easy to just hit the 9 key, you know, repeatedly when there's not an emergency. So here we are with 911. Happy 79th birthday to Glenn Schrock, known better to you as the lead singer in the Little River Band.
It's all up to you, but whatever.
Glenn Schrock was born in Kent, England, and moved to Adelaide, Australia when he was 10 years old. And that's where the Little River Band was formed, one of Australia's big acts in the U.S. in the 70s and 80s. Mike Tyson is 57 years old today. On this day in 1953, the first Chevy Corvette rolled off the assembly line in Flint, Michigan. So the Chevy Corvette is 70 years old today. All right, we mentioned the Huey Lewis and the News album Sports, and in the background you're going to hear Walking on a Thin Line, which is one of my favorites off of there. It was talking about how tough it was for Vietnam veterans to come back and try to integrate into society, and apparently it's a song that's resonated well with veterans from Afghanistan and Iraq as well. Anyway, the note, the historical note about Sports is it went to number one for this week in 1984, but for the whole year of 1984, there were only 5 albums that sat in the number one spot because they sat there for so long. 1984 didn't just give us Sports. It gave us Thriller. It gave us Purple Rain. It gave us Springsteen's Born in the USA. And it gave us Footloose. Not a bad year, 1984. And finally, this day in 2017, Jay-Z releases his album 444, which addresses the infidelity accusations that Beyonce leveled at him in her album Lemonade. And on this day in 2019, Donald Trump became the first sitting U.S. president to visit North Korea. Took me too long for this song. I don't deserve you. All right, I think it's time to give away some Brewers tickets. Let's get to the rules first. And I got clarity on this through Aaron and Mr. Mathers. It says you cannot have won a prize in this month. And we thought, well, did they mean 30 days or what? No, it's the calendar month. So theoretically, you could win something today and you could win something tomorrow. But you can't have won something earlier in the month of June in the calendar month. You must be able to have these Brewers tickets emailed to you. And my own personal rule, you must be able to use them. These are great club seats that are over on the third base side of home plate. So here comes the question. And remember, Aaron's going to be juggling the phones here. So you might have the right answer, but just let the phone keep ringing until we tell you that we've got a winner. And again, the number is 844-967-2789. There are six retired Milwaukee Brewers numbers. Every team has retired Jackie Robinson's 42. Bud Selig was given the number one when it was retired in his honor. That leaves four other retired numbers, 4, 19, 34, and 44. Name all four Milwaukee players whose numbers are retired. The first one through with all four names gets these great tickets, four tickets, club level, to the Brewers and Cubs game Monday afternoon at 844-967-2789. Again, the four Milwaukee players whose numbers are retired, their numbers were 4, 19, 34, and 44. And you don't have to match the name to the number, but that's just my way of giving you a hint. And Aaron's working the phones right now, and if he gets a winner, he will just barge in and let us know that that's the case. But again, one last time on the phone number, 844-967-2789. We're going to have Dan Schumacher coming up in our next hour, give us a little update on his new gig. He had visited with us as the athletic director at UW-Eau Claire for quite some time, and now he is doing the same at Northland College up in Ashland. So we'll get an update, and we'll get a chance to talk a little bit about sports as well. And then Mark Jacob will be along and talk about press coverage of the U.S. Supreme Court decision abolishing affirmative action.
Well, Pat, it looks like we have somebody who called in with the right answer. We have Doc from Milwaukee.
Hey, Doc, good morning.
Good morning.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing well, thank you.
All right, well, let's try to make it a little bit better. Who are the four players who have had their uniform numbers retired by the Brewers?
Well, you got 4, Paul Molitor, 19 is Robin Yount, 34 is Riley Fingers, and 44 is Hank Aaron.
There you go. That's it. We got a winner. 4 tickets for Monday. Did you have plans already? I hope this helps make your holiday weekend a little bit easier.
Yeah, no, I didn't have any plans.
All right. Do you have people in mind for using these tickets, or are you going to make new friends over the weekend?
Yeah, I got some people in mind.
Okay. Well, I think that's going to be a nice surprise for them, Doc. Thank you for calling in. Thanks for listening, and have a really nice weekend.
Thanks. You too.
All right. And Aaron's going to get the info from you if he didn't already. So while he does that, I was looking at what else had been making news here, and it never ceases to amaze me, you know, what kinds of things will get people riled up. What one person really thinks is a great idea, the other person says, no, not so much. And the headline says, in this Maine town, they envisioned the world's tallest flagpole. Instead of uniting them, it's dividing them. And it's an Associated Press story that talks about the dream of some folks there to have a flagpole jutting upward from the woodlands toward the spacious skies, the tallest one ever, higher than the Empire State Building, and a massive American flag bigger than a football field, visible from miles away on a clear day. It was going to be a $1 billion project funded in part by donations that would unite people of all political stripes. But instead, a lot of folks around there thought it would involve a massive scar on the landscape, too much development. It would be bad for the environment. It just goes to show that, you know, one person's dream is, you know, another person's nightmare. And unfortunately, over this 4th of July, they're going to spend it talking about whether the world's tallest flagpole is a good thing or a bad thing for them. Well, as we head into the holiday weekend, we've got your full weatherology forecast for across the state of Wisconsin coming up in just a bit. More headlines, and as mentioned before, Dan Schumacher and Mark Jacob as well. We'll be back. You're up north.